On the programme, on the verge of closure, Books Ireland finds a new lease of life, and Dancing the Spirit of Agnes Burnell, Cuishcame Dance Company honour one of the great figures of modern music and theatre. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. First, we look at a magazine that has been at the cornerstone of news, reviews and debate of books in this country for the last 38 years. Books Ireland has been appearing 9 times a year since 1976 and had become an important resource for book lovers, libraries, publishers and more or less everyone interested in books and publishing in Ireland. In December, its founding editor announced that he was printing the final issue, the news seeming to mark the end of an era and the demise of another publication that gave significant space to an essential aspect of the arts in this country. But it's a story with a happy turn, at least for now, with a new publisher taking over and a first new issue just out. In a little while, we'll hear from that new publisher and from the new editor of the magazine. But first, I've been speaking to the founder editor of Books Ireland, Jeremy Addis, who told me about the genesis of the publication.
The Irish Book Publishers Association, CLAE, had been publishing a sort of joint catalogue for its members, which had turned into a kind of a magazine with the odd article and picture. And suddenly we couldn't afford to go on publishing it. I was on the CLAE committee then, and I thought, well, here was an opportunity to produce a magazine that reviewed Irish books only, or Irish interest books only.
And what was your hope and intention with the magazine? Obviously, as you say, that emphasis on books published in Ireland, books of Irish interest. Who was it intended for or aimed at?
Obviously for librarians and for booksellers and for Irish studies people. My main intention was to make myself a living, which I didn't quite do for some years after that, but it became a spare time job.
Of course, you'd been involved in publishing before with Brown and Nolan and the Irish University Press, both important publishers, but both destined to fold. How hard was it for Irish publishing companies to survive, or indeed to do more than that, to turn a profit at all in the late 60s and 70s?
Very, very difficult. There was an explosion of Irish publishing because Irish University Press, which, as you say, I was on the staff of, a lot of their staff decided to go off and start publishing houses themselves, Wolfhound Press, of great memory. Two or three other ones, Mercia Press had already been established, the Dolman Press, Liam Miller's thing had been established since, I think, 1951. But there was, as I say, a sudden explosion of Irish publishing, which was quite exciting. And Books Ireland began in the height of that.
The first edition appearing in April 76. March, not April. Ads from many of the big British publishers, and even from Burke's Peerage.
Yes, well, we decided we'd try for advertising from the big English publishers, a lot of whom had Irish authors on their books. And we got such a response from them, Thames and Hudson, and as we say, Burke's Peerage, and three or four others, that we decided we ought to perhaps make that issue number two and start a little earlier with Irish advertising, or it would look like a sort of colonial enterprise.
And what kind of response did you get from Irish companies in terms of backing and advertising?
Enthusiastic and very helpful, marvellous.
And, of course, from early on as well, the Arts Council provided backing, provided support, which would become very important in terms of maintaining the magazine over more than 3.5 decades.
Yes, it was at the end of the first year, in the winter of 1976, 77, that I took it to the Arts Council because it just wasn't making commercial sense. And very nicely, they offered me £100, which I gratefully accepted. And that became an annual grant that went on through the years until we were receiving 10,000 from them most recently.
How did it work in terms of a balance between subscriptions, advertising, and that critical support from the Arts Council?
That's traditionally how it's worked out, a third from each. That's to say from sales, from subscriptions, which is postal subscriptions, which is the main part of the readership, a third of our revenue, from advertising another third, and from the Arts Council's, both Arts Councils, incidentally, the remaining third. The Northern Ireland Arts Council gave us lottery money, which is rather interesting, British lottery money. In the end, they were giving me more than the Arts Council in Ireland was giving us.
What then were the defining features of Books Ireland over the years? I know you're very keen on design and how it looked as well as what it contained.
Yes, I'm not a very good designer myself. I'm inclined to make things too dense, to pack material into the space to give good value, which means it didn't quite have the elegance of the new issues that's starting now. But our principle was essentially to list and review everything that came out of Irish interest, Irish publication or Irish authorship, or in each case rather than and. And what we've heard very often since was that from poets and novelists and short story writers, that nowhere else did they get a mention, but from Books Ireland they got a review. And that's what I'd love to hear more than anything. We were against bestsellerism, where everybody reviews the book of the day and all the other books are forgotten or fall by the wayside.
You know, I think you would argue that there isn't nearly enough space given, critical space given, to Irish books. There's almost a prejudice against Irish published books in the mainstream media.
Certainly was the case then. I don't know. I think it's much less the case now. I think the newspapers and magazines are more inclined to explore what's really coming out, but still the problem does exist.
Tell me about one particular feature of Books Ireland, which became very popular, the first flush column, a list and summary, I suppose, of new Irish published books or books of Irish interest. It must have been quite a task to put that together.
It's a horrible task, actually, yes, a very laborious one. I remember we intended to put it off. The books stacked up. We were getting 50 a month, sometimes 75 a month. And I used to have a boat on the Shannon. And I remember thinking I shouldn't really go down to the boat, but I've got all these books to list. So I put them all in a sack. I could almost not lift it, and carried them down to the boat and sat up with a portable computer in the boat and listed them there. But it was a very laborious job. But it was a very important one, because that's where the books that didn't get a review were got some notice and some assessment.
Do you know who your audience has been over the years? I mean, were you aware of that, of who was buying Books Ireland?
Until I closed down, there's something I didn't realise. Very often when people were renewing their subscription, they'd scribble "keep up the good work" or some encouraging remark like that when they were enclosing their cheque or their Visa card number or whatever. When I was producing the last issue, the final issue, as I called it, in December, the beginning of December last, I got 30 or 40 emails which showed a real affection for the magazine, which I'd never suspected. They were emotional and very affecting messages from all sorts of people, just librarians, people abroad, a German librarian in Berlin, and all sorts. But where they'd got this personal attachment, it was hard to tell, because I didn't show myself much. I didn't write editorials, and I tended to be the editor you didn't know was there kind of thing. And yet these were addressed to me. It was curious, but a little bit frightening.
What are you proudest of from the decades of producing Books Ireland?
Well, I suppose the answer is the decades, yes. The 38 years in which we've never been late. Once we were late, actually, there was a post-strike. We had to ship all the magazines up to the Blackstaff Press in Belfast, who promised to post them for us. And there was a bank strike once, but that didn't make us late. So we've always got stuck to our deadlines and always got the magazine out on time. And I'm very proud of that.
Did you ever row in yourself as a reviewer?
Occasionally, yes. I used to do a news column or a chat column. And a curious thing occurred that I was a little bit inclined to be waspish or to go for a cheap jibe at people, and I found I could all too easily hurt people, and so I tended to take myself out of it and to just keep the editor job, and that's the way it stayed.
One review that I suppose may stand out in many people's memory was a review from 2012 by Kevin Kiley of Michael D. Higgins' New and Selected Poems before he was elected president, where he's Kevin Kiley accused him of crimes against literature. Did you ever regret publishing that review?
No, I think that showed that we could be independent, and it was a reasonable review. It wasn't gratuitously nasty.
Did you get much response to it?
Not all that much, to tell you the truth. No.
Probably more in the other newspapers than actually response from readers.
Yeah, exactly. Journalists looking for a story.
And I suppose, as you say, you take that as a mark of the independence of Books Ireland and the need to publish things that might not be popular necessarily.
Right. I think that's true, yeah.
You have strong opinions as well about the need for publishers to use and support Irish printers, you know, rather than go to, say, Hong Kong or China as a cheaper option, but therefore not supporting what's here.
It's a terrible problem, really. Irish printers cannot seem to compete with printers in, well, Spain, Holland, Belgium, Hong Kong, India. You can print books cheaper almost anywhere in the world than in Ireland, and that seems terribly wrong somehow. That the buzzing and exciting publishing industry in Ireland can't earn money for the printers as well as for the publishers.
I remember in December I had an email from a friend in Sligo saying, terrible news, the last issue of Books Ireland is about to come out. And he was devastated at this prospect. A significant change happened, which means it will survive this new issue coming out.
It really was a miracle. If you'd asked me 3 months ago, you know, what impossible dream have you got? It would be that I'd stop the magazine and that a publisher with well practiced at bringing out magazines and with very successful magazines would bid to take me over. And that is exactly what happened. Within 24 hours of my producing the December magazine, which said it was the last issue, I had a phone call from Nick Maxwell saying, could he come round and talk? And he did. And in the space of a few minutes, we did the deal.
Why had you decided to call it a day?
We lost the Arts Council money. It was understandable for the Arts Council because suddenly our advertising revenue had disappeared almost overnight.
This is the result of the crash of the recession here.
Exactly, exactly. Suddenly, Irish publishers couldn't afford to advertise. It was one of the little luxuries that had to go first of all. With the result that the Arts Council found it was the major source of revenue for the magazine. In a sense, it had become their magazine, and obviously they couldn't support that, so they had to pull out altogether. And I heard that early in November and made a decision on the spot to stop publishing.
That must have been a very hard decision to make.
It was a hell of a difficult decision, yes.
Because you clearly loved what you did and what you've done.
Yes, it had just become part of my life. I didn't, as it were, love it any more than it loved me, but it was something that just happened every month for 38 years, and suddenly it was going to stop happening. On the other hand, I'd just hit 80-something, 82, so obviously something had to go at some time. So perhaps it was the right moment. I'm sure it was the right moment.
I suppose retirement at 82 isn't too bad in the scheme of things. But nonetheless, I'm sure you're delighted. This new look, a new edition of The World of Irish Books, Books Ireland, just out, and that must be gratifying for you.
It's more than just gratifying, because it's a very good job. It was a bit untactful of them to produce a better magazine than mine, I thought. maybe they be forgiven. But it's a very good magazine. It's a very good value. And I think where the old Books Ireland needed to die, this one needs to live.
Jeremy Addis, founding editor of Books Ireland there. I've also been speaking to one of the publishers of the new look Books Ireland, Una McConville, and to its new editor, Tony Canavan. I first asked Una McConville about the decision to take over the magazine.
When we realised what was happening, we just had to do it. I just could not see it go. I've always loved it, and I've always loved the work that Jeremy has done on it. So we're delighted.
Because you also produce History Ireland and Archaeology Ireland. So this becomes, I suppose, a third part of a trinity of publications from yourselves.
It does. We've been in magazine publishing since 1987. We started Archaeology Ireland in 1987. And then we took over History Ireland, which had been established in 1993. And then we took it over in 2003. So, as you say, a nice trinity now of magazines.
Tony Canavan, you're the new editor of Books Ireland, and this first issue, of course, just out. Tell me what changes you're planning to make, and also what continuity you feel is essential with the publication.
Essentially, what we want to do is to keep it the same, but help it evolve again, because we're trying to extend the readership and bring more people in. We're maybe bringing in more items and more features that hadn't been there before. In particular, we're now introduced a book club focus, which is turned to be very interesting. I mean, there are just hundreds of book clubs throughout Ireland. And if you like, they're at the end of the line when it comes to the book worlds in Ireland. You know, I say, we have the writers at one end of the spectrum, if you like. Then the other end, we have the readers, and the readers are really organised in book clubs. And so we're trying to reach out to them. So that's turned out to be quite a fun kind of thing to do, to meet people in book clubs and find out why they go there, how do they choose the books, what kind of books do they read, and so on.
It's very striking looking at this first new issue, to see the number of books that are slated to come out over the next few months. Yes. And it really brings home the extent of publishing, just how much is published in this country, even over a 3 or 6 month period.
Well, it's amazing now. I mean, even after the crash, you know, they're still not, the publishing industry is still very strong. And sometimes we would be getting maybe 20, 30 books a week coming into us for the First Flush column, which is incredible, you know. And that was one of the reasons why we felt that, there was a market out there for Books Ireland, that because the publishing industry itself is so strong, the readership is so strong. And, it's great to see, you know, if you think in terms of Ireland being the size of country that it is, the population we have. And yet I'm sure per head of population, we probably have more publishers than quite a few of the bigger countries, you know.
Tony Canavan, new editor of Books Ireland there, and before him, Una McConville, publisher. Also, Jeremy Addis, the founding editor of the magazine, speaking to me at his home in Dublin. Well, at the launch of the new Books Ireland in Dublin last week, many people from the world of books, writing and publishing gathered to pay tribute to the work of Jeremy Addis over almost four decades and to celebrate this new beginning for the magazine. Nuala Macklin was there for Arts Tonight.
Pat Wallace, former director of the National Museum of Ireland. What has Books Ireland magazine meant to you over the decades?
Over the decades, it contained announcements of new titles, very pithy, kind of synopsized, but very meaty reviews which were useful. I remember one of my own efforts was very favourably done by Henry Wheeler, God rest him. But I think the new approach is absolutely better and most welcome, and long may it thrive, really.
And would you say that in general sufficient space is devoted to serious literary criticism in Ireland?
Well, I'm not a literary critic. I'm involved in heritage studies, history studies, archaeology, all of that. So I'm not into literature very much. So this is an opportunity for people in my field, or the various fields that kind of congregate around the past and the books that are published. We have a great record in Ireland, some great small publishing houses doing works of really transnational importance, international importance. The way to signify these and to signal their arrival is to get quality scholars and experts and relevant people to review it in Books Ireland.
Sue Leonard, popular author here in Ireland. Can you tell us, what has Books Ireland magazine meant to you over the decades?
I started writing for Books Ireland when I was a very new journalist. And what was so wonderful, reviewing for Books Ireland rather than for the papers, was that you had a theme you could more or less do what you like. But I think the great thing about Books Ireland was that it did cover everybody. And there are so many authors who don't get reviewed. The Irish Times tends to be a particular specialist, and the Independent will be perhaps the more popular ones. But for the literary author coming along, sometimes they get completely ignored, and Books Ireland would always cover them. And I think that was so, what was so fantastic about it.
Tommy Graham, History Ireland. Can you tell us, what has Books Ireland meant to you over the decades?
Well, I first came across Books Ireland over 20 years ago when I started editing History Ireland magazine. Our problem then was we were only quarterly. We only could review, you know, a tiny percentage of the books that were submitted to me. So I was always thankful to Jeremy Addis and Books Ireland because they reviewed everything, you know. So it was with some trepidation I read of its imminent demise a few months back in the Irish Times, but luckily that wasn't the case. So I can rest easy again and not have to dodge people at book launches like this whose books haven't been reviewed in History Ireland, because they will be reviewed in Books Ireland. I'm very confident for its future. I've known, obviously, the publisher, Nick Maxwell, who also publishes History Ireland, for over 10 years. Tony Canavan, the new editor, he was in at the ground floor of History Ireland, so I know Tony even longer. I'd be very, very confident for the future. The only slightly sour note, you might say, is the withdrawal of Arts Council funding, but maybe that'll come back on stream into the future.
Nuala Macklin reporting there from the launch of Books Ireland in Dublin last week. And we'll be looking at a number of other publications online and in print, and discussing critical discourse around literature, music and the visual arts in the coming weeks. Still to come on tonight's programme, Cuishcame Dance Company honour one of the outstanding figures in Irish and German music and musical theatre. Chansonette there, Agnes Burnell singing. Burnell, a truly remarkable figure in music and musical theatre over many decades, possessed of a unique voice and stage presence, a brilliant interpreter of the songs of writers like Kurt Weill and Frank Wedekind, and the German cabaret artists of the 1920s and 30s. Burnell made a number of groundbreaking albums with the late Philip Chevron and was deeply committed to the early work done at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin. Her extraordinary life will be remembered there in a dance show and parallel programme of talks, archive film screenings and a photographic exhibition, the dance show opening this Thursday. Taking six of her songs and building dance around them, Cuishcame's show Agnes will explore aspects of Burnell's creative voice and inspirational spirit. Their founder and director, David Bulger, credits Burnell with fostering his love of theatre and dance as a boy, as we'll hear later. First, though, Mark Leslie, Agnes Burnell's son, has been telling me about his mother's life. The family escaped Nazi Germany for London, Agnes travelling ahead of her parents.
She had the clarity that only just, I think she was about 13 when Hitler came to power. And she said, "Mum and Dad, you know, this guy is serious. I think my career as a star in Germany," which she was being groomed for stardom by her father, "isn't going to happen. I think the English-speaking world is the future of the world. I want to go to America, but as an interim, send me to a boarding school in England so I can learn the English language fluently," which she did. And in a way, that's what saved all their lives, because they had somewhere to, because of her being there, the British accepted them, you know, when they arrived in rather a panic with their, you know, their newly minted Hungarian passports. They'd established the right to residency through her being at school in England.
Of course, her father had been this theatre impresario. He'd made a film, I think, in 1930, or 1931, quite a celebrated film. And she made her first appearance in film, what, at the age of seven?
At the age of seven, yes. And she used to sit on his lap as a child and say, that actor, not that actor, because as he moved from theatre into movies, he took a lot of advice from her. You know, and he said there were a lot of quite famous German actors and actresses would be shocked if they think they got the part in whatever movie, you know, it was, through the advice of the seven-year-old. He was quite an egalitarian father. He took children seriously, said, but you must behave as an adult and be my friend, you know, not my father. And in fact, he was responsible for the career of Marlene Dietrich, who he spotted and had as a, you know, chorus girl in one of her shows. And even much to our delight, when Marianne Faithfull was living over in, and we discovered that her mother, Countess Sacher Masoch, descended from the man of masochism fame, turned out to have got her break in the theatre from my grandfather as well.
Then, of course, your mother famously took quite an active part in Allied and British propaganda during the Second World War, broadcasting into Germany on behalf of the British Special Operations Radio, and having quite an impact during that time.
Well, quite extraordinary, and I'm researching, I'm determined that there's a movie or a television series on it, because it's just astonishing, sort of war-winning, you know, ripping, you know, spiffing wheezes, and a hugely humorous element to, you know, because what they did is rather more subtle than the Nazis, who had lard ha-ha sort of going, Yabu sucks on the radio. The British set up two fanatical Nazi propaganda radio stations, one called Soldaten Center West for the German army, and one called Atlantic Center Calais for the Navy, putting out such balmy Nazi propaganda that it was designed to undermine the faith of German citizens in the sanity of their leaders, and actually proved incredibly effective, because they understood that people will twiddle the radio dial till they get the music that they want to hear. And real Nazi radio stations just had Furt Wangler conducting the ring at Bayreuth, whereas my mother had the benefit of a captured brass band of the German Afrika Corps locked into the basement of Bush House in London and handed Glenn Miller notes. So in unmistakable stentorian German army terms, they were playing, you know, Papa sort of version of Glenn Miller. And most Germans stopped turning the dial till they got there. Plus, they had the advantage of Marlene Dietrich doing their signature songs. Now, she had no idea of it. My mother hijacked her in the Dorchester Hotel when she was on a propaganda and said, I'm going to lock you in a basement. I can't tell you what it's all about. And Marlene always reckoned that the best recordings she ever did were for that propaganda.
Your mother broadcast under the name Vicky, and once, I think, actually managed to get a German U-boat captain to surrender by what she broadcast directly and deliberately for him to hear.
Well, that was an extraordinary moment, and again, another potential war-losing moment. The Americans had broken out of the Normandy beachhead and were desperately trying to surround and trap the Germans in the Falaise Gap, which, had they succeeded, it could have ended the war that year. And the only way they could pour enough reinforcements was to strip the Queen Mary bare of everything, even lifeboats, and pack 5,000 combat soldiers in it each week and race over from New York and land the troops directly into the battle. So each run of the Queen Mary brought, you know, almost a division or two divisions over, packed in. But had that ship sunk, there would have been no rescue for the people on it. And the Germans obviously had spies in New York noting this, and Hitler personally put out a reward of $1 million to the U-boat crew that would nail the Queen Mary. Now, at that time, the Allies had air supremacy over most of the Atlantic, except for a hole in the middle that they couldn't quite reach. And they reckoned the Queen was safe because it's faster than the U-boats, unless they were on the surface. But Germany's top U-boat ace took the risk, said, I'll go for the $1 million, managed to break out of the Allied blockade surrounding the mouth of the Loire, and was headed right for the Queen in the gap where he could go on the surface fast enough to catch it. And when the intelligence reports got through to my mother's radio station, my mother asked the question, are those U-boat, would this captain be married by any chance? And Aladdin didn't run to that, but they said, well, he might be. But what we do know is none of the crews have had a home leave for 2 years. So if he is married, he probably hasn't seen his family in 2 years. So my mother went with a special sailor's request program that night when the submarine would have been on the surface, recharging its batteries, saying, Vicky has 3 very special kisses for the gallant boys in U-boat 135 on a mission of utmost importance to the Reich, and they'll be buoyed up in their quest by the wonderful news that the captain's wife is safely delivered of twin baby boys who may serve the fatherland as gallantly as their father. And there was a slightly puzzled message. A U-boat has just surfaced with a white flag. I think that was the final straw, because I think there were quite a lot of scandals in Germany, war heroes, wives being seduced by senior Nazi party members. There were rumours to that effect, probably again put out by my mother's radio station. But she does claim to be the only girl to capture a U-boat.
One remarkable detail from A Remarkable Life. Many of the films in which she appeared and documentary films about her will be seen, of course, in the Project Arts Centre under that title, Agnes on Screen from 7 to 70, curated by John Comiskey. What does the whole homage, the Kush Came dance piece and this programme concurrent with it mean to you and to the family?
Well, it's very moving because Agnes, I suppose, to sum her up, was one of those life-affirming people who lived through the best of times and the worst of times and just came out of it, you know, with the human spirit. I mean, she never lost her love of Germany and German culture and Berlin. She felt completely at home there. That was the city of her birth. She loved London, where she had her whole life, you know, as an actress at the time, the swinging 60s. She adopted Dublin as her third home and entered the cultural life of Dublin in the punk era, you know. And for someone to have been in the Weimar Republic, you know, acted in films, and to have been part of the sort of punk scene in Dublin and have recorded Kitty Ricketts with the Radiators, and had a deep understanding of human nature from all of that. She said, you know, the evil of what happened in the Third Reich could happen anywhere at any time. You know, it's inherent in all of us. Nobody can point the finger, you know, at the Germans. And yet she was completely aware of all the heroism, you know, of other Germans who'd helped save them. You know, she just fully engaged with life and people wherever she was. She was a force of nature. And it's an extraordinary tribute to somebody that they very much thought of one of their own in Berlin. You know, she was given a pension and regularly brought back to put on shows and was considered a Berliner. London, where she was considered a great, you know, Londoner. And Dublin, where she was very much adopted as one of our own here, you know, our own sort of Lily Marlene, our own figure from that era, who completely engaged with, you know, the Project Arts Theatre and was recording records with Elvis Costello and Mark Almond and having all sorts of young protégés have gone on to do great things in the world of Irish film, theatre and music, from everyone from Gavin Friday to kind of Gabriel Byrne, who she kind of mothered, you know. So it was an extraordinary, extraordinary life where she straddled so many worlds in one short lifetime.
Mark Leslie there, and this is Agnes Burnell singing Philip Chevron's Kitty Ricketts, which Mark mentioned there. Agnes Burnell there with Philip Chevron's song Kitty Ricketts. Photographer Amelia Steen has been working with director John Comiskey to assemble a selection of photos and images of Burnell for the programme at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin. She photographed the actress and singer during a Dublin Theatre Festival show in 1985. I met Amelia Steen at her studio in Dublin, and together we looked at some of the images of Burnell's life.
What we're looking at here is a collection of images from the collection of her son, Mark Leslie. And he has graciously loaned them to Kush Came to be viewed during the time that the dance piece is on in the Project Art Centre. So a number were selected from the photographs that he sent over, and all I've done here is very gently removed any big marks from very obvious areas on the photographs, and you can see what an extraordinary beauty that she was.
So beautiful. And that first image with
Marlene Dietrich.
Wonderful. Young Agnes Burnell and a classic Marlene Dietrich. It's a great, great image.
You know, she was a great beauty, a great performer, a great singer, a very warm and woman who was so interested in even in, when I met her in her later years, she was so interested in meeting people and discovering new things. I mean, she was in motion all the time, I think, in the way that she approached her life.
She was a, her, she and your father were friendly.
What happened, I think, is at that time I was working out of the same office as my dad. So she would come in, lots of people would come in from the theatre and so on to pick up photos or have a chat or pass the time of day. So for him, he got to meet kind of a whole other slew and generation of people. And Agnes, from a Jewish background, of course, identified with my dad, and they would have had, Mendel would have enjoyed meeting people of Jewish background. And of course, he would have known of her history of coming out of Berlin at the time of pre-Second World War and her activities during the Second World War. So she was heroic, you know, and there she was coming to collect a print from you, you know, and she was the most amazing woman to have ever encountered, I think.
Then when you took those photos, so it was the Dublin Theatre Festival in 1985, and the negatives are here from that show. What do you remember of that experience of taking those photos?
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting, because Bridget Webster, who's the company manager of Kushkane, was here a few days ago choosing these out. And I said, well, I don't really have any memory of it, because it was 1985. I was just starting out as a photographer. Project Art Centre at that time was welcoming to people like myself who had a camera and took a photograph and handed them back some prints. And of course, I was aware that she was somebody extraordinary and special. But what I see when I look at these now is that she was willing to work with somebody with a camera who was totally unknown. And she was the consummate performer, that she would take a few minutes out from her. This was probably, I would think, taken in those few minutes before a play goes up. So it wouldn't be rehearsal as much as she would be warming up for the show, and the lighting would be on, and there would be a few minutes, and then the audience would be let in and you'd be gone, or it was out the other side. So my instinct is that it was before, because normally after a show a performer would disappear more quickly into a dressing room. So I think she just gave me those few minutes.
Photographer Amelia Steen there. Among the photographs we looked at were images of Marlene Dietrich, a friend of Agnes Barnell's father, who was a huge influence in her life and career from early years. Here she is from the documentary The Fun Palace, broadcast on Lyric FM, remembering her childhood in Berlin and her beloved father.
My father used to take me not only to his own theatres, but, you know, to other things, and a lot to the opera. And that made life very interesting in many ways. And he also used to allow me to sit in on his script conferences when I was quite small. And eventually, when he started directing films, which he did in the early 30s, late 20s, early 30s, he got me in as a sort of casting director, because I was an enormous film buff, a film fan, and we had a little cinema in the square in which we lived. And I was always there when I could. You see, I could go there by myself because I only had to cross one road. It wasn't very dangerous. And I knew every single German film actor and film actress by name, and I knew what they had played. And so this was quite useful to my father. He made use of my knowledge.
Agnes Barnell there with Surabaya Johnny from Barnell on Brecht from 1977. David Bulger of Kushkane Dance Company is the person who has created the upcoming tribute to Agnes Barnell. She was a family neighbour in Dublin when he was a boy, and he credits her with fostering his love of theatre, dance and performance. He's been telling me about the inspiration for the show Agnes.
When I started the project, I kind of knew what I didn't want to do, and what I didn't want to do was have anyone play Agnes, because I thought, firstly, it's not possible. Could you imagine that it would be so difficult to play somebody like that? But with their songs, I looked into the songs and thought I would really try and get under the themes of them and start there. And then actually really choreograph some songs to the words, to the way she phrases things. So as a choreographer, I was taking the choreography, and I was asking the dancers to really dance in the way Agnes was phrasing things. But it, then as we got further into it, I realized that Agnes definitely was attracted to songs that meant something very, very deeply to her. And I suppose having known Agnes pretty well, in the sense that even though I was quite young, I would have known stories. I would have been in her house a lot. I used to actually mind her dog. She had two dogs, Phoebe and Sam. And when you walked into her house, I was always fascinated. She had these black and white tiles as you walked in the hallway, and with a wind-up telephone that kind of lift off the receiver, something you'd see in a Hollywood film. And you walked into the left, there was a sitting room with a desk in the front window. And on that desk had what I remember it being like a white leather-bound photo album. And as kids, of course, you know, photo album says, "Open me, please, open me." And we used to just open it. And I used to go with my sisters and we'd open it and see these photographs of this incredible, beautiful woman in all sorts of, you know, in her first performance as Salome in London, which was quite naked. So, of course, we find that funny. You know, here was the naked Agnes and she was our neighbour. And then, you know, of pictures of her wedding, pictures of her on set with people, pictures of her with Marlene Dietrich. Like, it just was so, the world of it was so fascinating to me. And I think she saw that I was interested in theatre. Like, I used to put on shows in our front garden. I probably, Agnes had passed several times watching me perform, you know, dragging my sisters around to do some kind of made-up play in the garden during the summer. And she invited me one day to come to the project with her. She was driving in and she drove me in the car. I remember it very clearly because I remember the window being open and Agnes had these great glass, and she had a very particular way of driving. She was kind of very much on top of the steering wheel, and probably a little bit precarious driving, just slightly. But anyway, we got to a project, and it was then, obviously it was Temple Bar, but it wasn't Temple Bar that we know now. It was, you know, in the 80s, and it was, you know, probably slightly run down. And we arrived at the old project, and she was bringing me to a drama class. And she literally left me into the drama class and then collected me afterward and asked me all about it and said, "How did I find it? How did I like it?" And of course, I loved it. And what was so, I suppose, brilliant now was that she just opened the door to the possibility of being able to be part of a little part of theatre, which of course I thought she was. You know, she was to me theatre. This neighbour was theatre and fascinating.
Later then, you actually choreographed her.
Yes. Well, that was incredible. Agnes had seen some of my work with Cush Came and seen a piece I made, and she kind of, after the show, she came to me and she said, "Darling, that was wonderful." And I said, "Thank you very much, Agnes." And of course, you know, I thought this is incredible that this woman suddenly was watching my work. And what she said to me was, I think there was some real pride in her, because it was quite a satirical piece I had made about De Valera's vision of Ireland then and where we were in Ireland now. It was called Real Look. And she said, "Satirical dance is wonderful." And I think that she could see maybe that there was something rubbing off on her, the way she would be able to sing a song and smile at you while kind of stick a dagger in you at the same time with the lyrics. And I think she enjoyed the fact that in the dance that I was trying to do that and trying to be funny with it. And she eventually asked me to choreograph for her, and she said, "David, would you choreograph? I'm doing a concert on Bernal and Brecht, and I'm doing the tango ballad from Trapani Opera." And there's a moment in that where the two singers can possibly dance together. And she said, "Would you choreograph the tango and the tango ballad for me?" And I said, "I would absolutely love to. It would be an honour." And she said, "But David, of course I can't dance." And it was that kind of brilliance about Agnes, like she'd ask you one thing and then she'd say she can't dance, but actually she could dance. She knew image really, really well. She understood movement. I think what she meant was she wasn't going to dance a tango. She was in her 70s. "I'm not dancing the tango." So actually we ended up talking about it, and we just got her a rose, and I put a little kind of cut into the rose, into the stem, and I had herself and the other singer fight over the rose in their mouth until it broke. And actually they did it so well that it was a dance. It was, you know, it was everything all in that one image, because she really did understand the way she would look. And I remember particularly in that she sang Surabaya Jani, and I will never forget the change she made. In she turned from one character and she picked up her scarf and just put it over her head and then turned back to the audience, and it was like her whole face had changed into this character to sing Surabaya Jani. And even though I don't speak German, I knew every word that she was saying. I knew every single thing. I knew every emotion. I knew she really embodied things in that way. And I suppose she has a truthfulness and a very simple way of performing, in the sense that she didn't have any big sets, or there was no, you know, she just used two chairs and maybe a glass of whiskey and a feather boa, and you know.
Entirely appropriate as well that the show will be seen for the first time in the Project Arts Centre, because, of course, she loved the project, didn't she?
She did, yeah. I mean, the project, I think, was her spiritual home. I think she was creative director there for a while. She was on the board of directors up until, I'd say, before she died. And she performed there many times. I met Tom Coughlin, who was the general manager a few years ago of Project, and he said, "Oh, Dave, you're doing Agnes. It's great." He said, "You know, we've been always trying to think of how we would do something when she died in 1999, and he said, "It's great that, you know, it's happening, and it's great that you're doing it." He said, "Of course, you know, Agnes had three or four comebacks here in the project, and that will be Agnes, you know, that these comebacks kept happening, and of course the last time ever in the project." And it's been very interesting in this process that, you know, it's obviously my creative voice or my creative head or my creative point. I've been really opening it up and trying to really channel Agnes in a way, and to try and be really guided, because a lot of people, I probably don't know this, but Agnes was a great director. She was a wonderful director and had many successes as her as a director. Of course, she was an actress as well and a singer, but I really feel her directing me. And I was talking to her daughter and Tony recently, and she said, "Oh yeah, she's directing you. Don't worry, she does that. She tends to do that." So I've really tried to leave it as open, and I know it's a creative muse maybe or a creative voice, but I'm allowing it to be hers because I want to be as clear as possible, and I want to, I suppose, honour her and honour her energy and her skill as an artist. And in the choreography, I've been really trying to strip back in the sense, because it's quite detailed, there's quite a lot in the show. The songs are really complex. They're little stories in themselves. They're like mini episodes of really good novels, and they're slices of life that are really important. And the way she sings them and the phrasing is particularly important. So I didn't want to overfill the show with lots of other movement ideas. I wanted to do enough movement that would allow her a chance to get in and allow an audience to get in to make up their mind as well. Because I don't want to kind of make up the audience mind and say, "This is how you should be and this is how you should be." I want them to find their way into it, because, again, there are so many sides to the performance, but to Agnes herself. And I think that to uncover certain amounts or to offer up certain stage pictures and allow the layering to speak to an audience, hopefully in a really exciting way. The other thing is she has such a wry sense of humour. It's an incredible sense of humour. And, you know, the worst thing we could do is go on and try to be funny. Let Agnes be funny. But I really tried to, I have a sense of humour in my work anyway, I think. So, but it's trying to embellish, or not embellish the humour, but allow it to come forward more, because they're very, very funny songs, as well as absolutely heartbreaking, but they're absolutely hilarious as well. On another, she's able to turn on a dime very quickly, and do that. And I love that. And of course, as a choreographer, that's an extraordinary thing, because you've got these wonderful ballads, and then you've got these wonderful fast up tempo funny songs, and I love those contrasting things.
Of course, as well as the show, Agnes, there's also a program of events remembering Agnes Burnell, and you know, showing us some of the films, the wonderful photographs, and again, so I was paying tribute to her life and showing some of the richness of her life. Tell me a little bit about that kind of concurrent program with the show, Agnes.
Well, it stemmed from my desire to, I think there's possibly a whole generation of people out there that would never have had the fortune to actually experience Agnes and the incredible life that she had. And I think by having the parallel program would allow people to find a little bit more about her. We've got the first film she ever appeared in, and she was a boy, that she played a boy. And the last film she appeared in that she made 3 months before she died of cancer. And when I saw the two of those, I saw the first one and the last one together, I realised, you know, I was quite moved by it. But the big thing that came across was a life really lived. And the one lesson I thought that I was learning from that was live your life as full and as rich as Agnes would. But also there are we have a live performance from the project that she made a few years ago, which I think is great to go along with this, because the one thing we don't have is Agnes, and we have her songs, and there are places for Agnes in the show, and we keep opening that. But to actually see her perform, I think, will be great. And I also think there's a documentary by John Comiskey, I Was a Little Girl, where he brought Agnes back to Berlin, where she grew up and had to leave before, or as the war broke out, and moved to London. But it gives you a chance to get to see her and get to see the way she delivers things and the way she phrases things and her stories. And her story as a child growing up in Berlin is fascinating.
David Bulger of Cushcame Dance Theatre there. And the show Agnes opens at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin on this Thursday, the 13th of March, and runs till March the 22nd. The parallel programme of film screenings, exhibitions and talks runs from March the 18th to the 22nd. See cushcame.ie for details. We leave you tonight with the voice of Agnes Burnell and Mark Almond's song It Was Me, which will feature in that Cushcame show. Back next Monday at 10. Till then, good night.